of my apartment with a pillow under my bloated stomach, I felt like even more of a failure. I looked at my diploma in the corner of the room, the notes from the last final on the floor by my computer, the medal I'd received for maintaining a 4.0 grade point average hanging on the folding chair, and the gifts and cards from my family piled by the door. I felt relief and great regret at the same time. I knew I had to get myself back up, figuratively and literally, and continue the long, hard journey of recovery, because I had no more excuses. A miracle cure. The next week, I moved back into my parents' house and began seeing a new therapist, psychiatrist, and nutritionist in my hometown. I did not get a job so I could devote my time to therapy, but even without the stress of school, my bulimia remained. My treatment at home was very similar to my treatment in college. I continued working on dealing with the daily triggers and the deep-rooted emotional reasons for my behavior. I still worked on curing my other problems, like depression and anxiety, and I still followed a meal plan. I still binged. I began to think I wasn't getting better because I simply wasn't good at therapy. I wanted to be less anxious, less depressed, manage my emotions well, have a good self-image, but this was very difficult for me. I worried that I'd never change and therefore be doomed to binge for the rest of my life. Sometimes I felt like I was making progress and sometimes I didn't. Sometimes I felt I understood why I was bulimic, and sometimes it was still a mystery to me. My new therapists were supportive and knowledgeable, but the result was the same. There was no marked change in my binge eating. However, I did learn one valuable lesson that would become vital to my eventual recovery. This lesson was about the link, really the lack of a link, between my bulimia and my emotions. In June 2003, my psychiatrist put me on a new medication called Topamax, Topramate. This particular medication was traditionally used to treat epileptic seizures, but at the time, it was beginning to be used in bulimics and showing decent results. Although I was wary about using an anti-epileptic drug, considering I had never had a seizure, I was desperate and decided to try it out. I used it in conjunction with my antidepressant, which I had been taking on and off throughout college. I was amazed that within a week or two of starting Topamax, I didn't want to binge eat very much. My appetite decreased. I cut my binging down from 4 times a week to once a week, then to once every 2 weeks, where it remained stable. By September of that year, I had lost a sufficient amount of the extra weight I was carrying. Even though I was still binge eating a little, I felt better than I had in years. The constant shame and disgust were suddenly nearly gone. I began an internship at a local news station and volunteered to do media for a local church in an attempt to find something fitting to do with my communication degree. I also got a part-time job working with children and adults with special needs. I helped a 12-year-old girl with cerebral palsy do her homework a few times a week, took care of an 8-year-old boy with learning disabilities for a couple of afternoons a week, and organized field trips and activities for adults in assisted living community homes. Ever since I was 6 years old, my mom had taken care of special needs citizens in and out of our home. One of my best friends growing up, Eden, who passed away during my sophomore year of college, was physically disabled and in my mom's care a few days a week. She was like a part of our family, and her death was difficult for me, not only because I would miss her terribly, but because I felt like I neglected her during the last few years of her life while I was caught up in my eating disorder. As young girls, Eden and I used to play for countless hours in my room, creating the elaborate, imaginative lives of our wish world kids, small figurine dolls who had rooms that transformed into beauty salons, pizza parlors, and playgrounds. We also played video games, watched countless hours of Disney movies, and memorized every word and song in The Little Mermaid. As a child, my greatest interests were doing active things outside, going to our neighborhood pool, playing basketball, football, and baseball with the boys on our street. But a few days, a week when Eden came over, I mostly put all that aside, not because I had to, but but because I wanted to and loved our time together. However, when I began dieting restrictively and exercising excessively, I selfishly placed my focus on weight ahead of most everything else in my life. When I was 8, I would not have considered leaving Eden to go outside to play with the boys. But when I was an upperclassman in high school, I often skipped hanging out with her so I could go to the gym or run. Then when I began binge eating and became consumed with my eating disorder and therapy in college, I didn't make much of an effort to contact her or any of my other friends from home. An eating disorder can be very secluding and can make even the most important people in your life fade into the background. I regret that I wasn't a good friend during that time, especially to Eden, because it turned out to be our last few years together. I thought about Eden a lot during the summer after college, as I still do today. Well on Topamax and temporarily unconsumed by the binge eating, I suddenly had time and mental space to think about meaningful things, even if some of those things were painful. I often wished I could stop by Eden's house, which was less than a mile from mine, just to talk or play a video game. I felt the capacity, for the first time in a long time, to be a true friend, to possibly build lasting relationships. That summer, I did start trying to make new friends in my hometown, and I reconnected with some old ones. I also began a long-distance relationship at the time with Greg, a cousin of one of my college friends, and the man who would later become my husband. It was amazing to have a life again, and surprisingly, it wasn't due to any changes I had to make in my personality. It had nothing to do with any progress I'd made in therapy. I simply stopped having those all-too-frequent urges to binge, all because of a medication that somehow regulated my brain. Topamax was not without side effects, however. I experienced a constant tingling in my fingers and toes, my head felt cloudy much of the time, and I got jittery often. Even though the side effects were preferable to the constant urges to binge, I worried about the possible long-term consequences of using Topamax. I had wanted to quit on my own, and I was concerned that I would become dependent on a drug. Despite my doubts, I continued to take Topamax because, after a taste of being somewhat normal again, I didn't want to go back. Unconsumed. I visited Greg in Chicago in 2003. We became closer and arranged for a few more trips to see each other. In September, we met in Missouri, which was halfway between our homes and about an 8-hour drive for each of us. I remember driving alone from my home to our meeting point, listening to music and some audio tapes about world religions, one of my budding interests at the time. I was amazed that I did not contemplate binge eating even once. As I drove, I thought about how different this trip was from the many drives I'd taken between my home and my university, when I thought about food constantly and stopped at nearly every exit to get more of it. On my way to meet Greg, I stopped to eat only when I was hungry, and I ate only enough to satisfy me physically. It was as if my mind was all of a sudden free to focus on other possibilities. In Missouri, we went on a canoeing trip, hiked in the Ozarks, and simply enjoyed our time together. I suddenly felt like myself again. The veil that I'd been under for so long was nearly lifted. And although my life's problems didn't disappear, my biggest problem had faded almost completely. I still had low self-esteem. I was insecure in my new relationship with Greg. I was still confused about my career direction. I still had unresolved family stressors. I still didn't cope well with many of my feelings. And I was still prone to depression, anxiety, and perfectionism. Yet, I'd nearly stopped binge eating in spite of all that. Topamax improved my real problem, my urges to binge, even though my other problems and flaws remained. Goodbye to therapy. This experience made me question everything I'd learned in therapy. Why had I sat in therapists and nutritionists' offices for 4 years? If taking Topamax could make my urges to binge disappear so quickly and easily, it made me angry with my therapists, who'd led me to believe that my flaws, insecurities, upbringing, and stress were to blame. But even with all that mostly still intact, this drug had basically eliminated the central issue that had consumed my life for years. Maybe there was no link between my bulimia and my emotional state after all, I thought. Or maybe it was simply unnecessary for me to resolve those internal problems in order to stop binging. Still, I wondered what would happen if I stopped taking the drug. Would my urges return as quickly as they had dissipated? Or would the effects be enduring? Those questions were answered soon enough. My honeymoon on Topamax was short-lived, as I suspected it probably would be. After roughly 4 months on the drug, in October 2003, the positive effects seemed to wear off, and I began having more and more urges to binge. My binge eating increased rapidly through October and November, until I was binging about as much as I had before graduation. My psychiatrist suggested that I increase the dose of Topamax, but I wasn't willing to take the risk of more side effects. Plus, I had no idea what the long-term consequences could be. I would have to find another way. My therapist remained constant in reminding me, neither Topamax nor any other drug could be a miracle cure for my bulimia. To be fully cured, I would have to resolve the underlying causes and triggers. Even though I had accepted this theory for a long time, it was difficult to swallow now because my experience on Topamax had taught me two very important lessons. First, that my urges to binge were the real problem. And second, that self-improvement work wasn't necessary in order for me to stop binge eating. For 4 months, my urges had nearly gone away, even though I had faced many stressors during that span, albeit nothing major. But still, there was the emotional roller coaster of starting a new relationship with Greg, the tension of my internship, and of living with my parents again. But through it all, I'd rarely binged. The whole experience was remarkable, yet very confusing and unsettling to me. I realized that maybe there was something going on within my brain that generated my urges to binge. Something that Topamax had somehow temporarily suppressed. I began to think that maybe my eating disorder was all in my head, or more accurately, all in my brain, not the result of my upbringing or my personal weaknesses at all. I knew this was an important insight, but I wasn't quite sure at the time how it could help me recover. All I knew then was that I wouldn't return to therapy. After seeing that I could stop binge eating without it, I just didn't see the point. Therapy had not helped me with binge eating thus far, so I figured I couldn't do much worse on my own. I stopped taking medication at the end of November 2003, and I promised myself I would never re-enter a therapist's office for help with my eating disorder. This time, I kept my promise. Chapter 8. Some things change, some remain the same. Shortly after I stopped taking Topamax and vowed never to return to therapy, I made another very important decision in my life. I decided to move to a new city, 1,500 miles away from home, with Greg. He'd landed a good job in Phoenix, and I would go with him, take classes at the university there, and eventually attain a master's degree in religious studies. Although I wasn't exactly sure what I'd do with such a degree, the subject interested me greatly. I thought that the move and new academic goals would help me focus attention away from my struggles with food. There was one big problem, however. I wondered how I would face Greg daily when I was binge eating so much. Living far apart as we had been, it had been easy for me to hide my bulimia, but I knew if we lived together, there would be nowhere for me to hide. I was afraid Greg could never love me as a bulimic, so only a few weeks before I was to move, I called him on the phone to tell him I was reconsidering. I told him that we might have begun our relationship under false pretenses, because I'd been taking Topamax then, and was temporarily uncontrolled by my eating disorder. I told him I thought I had to get well before we could live together. Greg was supportive and understanding from the moment I told him about my eating problem. He urged me to move in with him despite my doubts, saying we'd get through it together. He said he didn't care how much I weighed or how much I ate, he'd still love me. I was reluctant to believe him, feeling altogether unlovable while my behavior was so out of control. So I was just going to tell him that my decision was final, that our plans were off, but I couldn't get the words out. I clutched the phone and started to cry, and my crying turned into sobbing, and I couldn't speak for a few minutes. It hurt that my eating disorder was again stripping me of opportunities, ruining any hope I had for a normal life. As I was sobbing, trying to spit out, "I can't move," something else came out instead. "I love you." A few weeks later, at the beginning of January 2004, I packed my bags and drove from Louisiana to Arizona to be with him. Back in front of the pantry. My dad drove me. We took our time, stopped at a few landmarks and one very odd Western museum. I'll always remember those 2 days with him. Ever since I stopped running in college, I felt my relationship with my father had changed. He was also a runner until a severe hip injury stopped him, and I know he loved it when I became serious about the sport. We were always close, but running seemed to draw us closer. He'd ride his bike with me while I ran around our hometown, and even in silence, we had a connection on the road. Now, driving westward, there he was at my side again, still supporting me in the biggest decision of my adult life thus far, even though I knew he didn't want me to move away and certainly didn't agree with me moving in with a man prior to marriage. We stopped in New Mexico for the night after our first day of driving. And after he went to bed, one of my urges to binge got the best of me, and I ate many of our snacks for the next day's drive. I knew I couldn't eat everything or he would notice, so I managed some semblance of control. I had to find a way to undo the damage of the mini-binge, so I woke up the next morning, an hour before him, to quietly do exercises in our small hotel room. I was in the shower by the time he woke up, my sweaty clothes tucked away in my bag. We got on the road again, and within hours, we had crossed the Arizona state line. My dad took a picture of me by the welcome sign. I still have that photo of me, on the side of the highway, wearing my baggy sweatshirt to hide the previous night's binge. It had been hard enough hiding the extent of my bulimia from my parents all those years, from my dad on just this 2-day journey. I again worried about how in the world I was going to deal with the daily reality of it while living with Greg. Once we arrived in Phoenix, my dad stayed a few days for some sightseeing. Then Greg and I brought him to the airport. I hugged him goodbye, and then he walked toward airport security. He turned around one more time, and I could see the tears welled up in his eyes. I waved bravely and held tight to Greg's hand. As my dad walked out of sight down the terminal, Greg hugged me for a long time as I cried too. Then my new life began. Greg never pitied me for my eating problems, as others had done, but he showed support and love, whether I was or wasn't doing well with my binge eating. I thought that perhaps having a friend, ally, and lover in him would help my urges go away, but I kept binge eating, even as our love and friendship grew stronger. Greg wasn't the healthiest eater, and he kept a lot of my favorite binge foods in our apartment. Sweet cereal, cookies, donuts. Just like I'd done to Julia, I stole his food. Of course, he said I could eat any of his food that I wanted, but binge eating his food was stealing in my mind. It was wasteful, indulgent, and selfish. I replaced his food as quickly as possible, and I told him not to stop buying what he liked on account of me. That never worked anyway. Even in the absence of easily accessible binge food, I still got it one way or another. I remember feeling so guilty because I often wished he would leave the apartment or go to sleep so I could satisfy my urges to binge. When I binged while he was sleeping, I felt too ashamed afterward to get into bed, so I would sleep on the floor. Often in the middle of those nights, I'd wake up to find him sleeping next to me on the floor. At the time, this bothered me because I felt so disgusting and unworthy of affection. But now I can appreciate this show of unconditional love. Greg and I really didn't talk much about my eating disorder. He didn't want to be intrusive, and I didn't want to discuss it. I had done enough of that in therapy. I knew he would always be there to listen, but I was burned out on the whole situation. I wanted to move on, but I remained stuck. Although I didn't intend it, my eating disorder hurt Greg often. I canceled several dinner dates because I had binged that day and no longer felt like going to a restaurant. I canceled weekend plans to go shopping, sightseeing, hiking, take a road trip, because I had to work out for hours on end to purge. At times, Greg took this as an affront to him, as if I'd rather binge than be with him. That was certainly the case when my urges were present, but otherwise it was not true, and I hated that I made him feel that way. But even when he was hurt, he didn't get angry or ridicule me, as another guy had done in college. I had a brief relationship with a guy named David during my senior year, and I decided to open up to him about my eating problems. It usually just made me feel foolish, but my therapists were encouraging me to confide in people I trusted, to garner their support in my recovery efforts, so I heeded their recommendation. When I told David, he asked sarcastically, "So you'd rather eat chocolate cake than be with me?" Despite his insensitivity, David was right. Yes, when my urges to binge hit, I certainly would have chosen to eat cake over hanging out with him. Likewise, when my urges were present in that small apartment with Greg, I longed to leave him so I could eat the way I wanted to. No relationship, no other form of fulfillment ever satisfied my urges to binge once they hit, and nothing else besides the temporary relief I got from Topamax, seemed to be able to stop those urges from coming in the first place. Marriage. Even though I loved Greg, loved living in our new city, and loved my graduate school studies, it all became too much to handle. I couldn't keep up with my coursework, my part-time job caring for a man with cerebral palsy, and my relationship while I was binge eating 4 times a week and spending 6 to 7 hours at the gym on days after binges. Something had to give. So I dropped out of my classes in March 2004, less than 3 months into the semester, feeling like a failure again for letting my eating disorder get in the way of my future plans. I felt lost when it came to my career direction. I had gone from wanting to be a publicist for a band to possibly wanting to be a teacher of world religions, and there were countless other ideas in between, none of which I felt capable of pursuing while bulimic. I had this pervasive idea in my head that once I recovered from bulimia, I'd figure everything out. Then I'd be able to choose and pursue a meaningful career, get married, and have children. A therapist had once suggested that I use the eating disorder as an excuse to stay stagnant and not pursue goals. The theory was that I was afraid to fail, so I used my binge eating and purging to avoid trying. If I could always blame my lack of success on my eating disorder, then I'd never have to bear the ego hit of failure. I don't believe this was true. I blamed my eating disorder for my failures, not to avoid feeling personally inadequate, but because my eating disorder made me feel personally inadequate. Around the time I dropped out of grad school, Greg proposed to me. After work one day, he told me to meet him on a nearby mountain we loved to hike. He brought a picnic so we could eat and watch the sunset. This would have been very enjoyable, but I had just finished binge eating. I felt bloated and uncomfortable, and couldn't take pleasure in the dinner he'd prepared. I told Greg that I'd binged and that I was sorry I wasn't in a good mood. He reiterated what he'd been telling me all along, that he supported me and that he'd stand by me and help me in any way he could. Then, to my surprise, as the sun began to set, He got down on one knee at the top of the mountain and pulled out a ring. We talked about marriage before, but since we'd known each other for only 8 months, it seemed a little premature. Greg is 5 years older than me, and he was ready for marriage at the time. I was unsure. If I hadn't binged that day, I truly believe I would have said yes. I loved him, and even though we hadn't known each other all that long, and I was still young, it felt right. But that day, feeling bloated and worthless, I told him no, or more specifically, not yet. In my mind, not yet meant I needed to wait until after I'd recovered, although I doubted recovery would come anytime soon. We talked more about marriage over the next month, and he made me realize that recovery wasn't a prerequisite. Still, he'd wait until I was ready. To his surprise this time, I made my decision quickly, proposing to him only a month later. We had a civil marriage right away, then 6 months later, a very small church wedding with only our family present, me wearing dressy pants and a white blouse. There were practical reasons for our decision to have a non-traditional wedding. However, my eating disorder factored into it as well, as it had factored into most aspects of my life since high school. I didn't feel capable of making it through the traditional process. The pressure of fitting into the perfect dress, of being the center of attention, of all the work required to plan a wedding. Shortly before our church ceremony in November 2004, we moved into a new house. As we unloaded boxes, I resolved that I would change. I won't binge in this house, I thought. It wasn't a dorm or an apartment with access to vending machines or workout centers. It was our home, and I'd act like an adult, putting foolish ways behind me in our new life together. But as with all other major changes in my life, it brought the same pattern of binge eating and over-exercising. I didn't understand it. I had everything I could have hoped for. I had even found a job close to our new house as a teacher's assistant in an elementary school special education classroom. The job fit my skills and personality. I found meaning in it. I liked all of my co-workers, and each of the kids I worked with touched my heart and my life. I'd found a small place in the world with my new husband, our new home, and my new job. And although it wasn't a perfect life, it was a good life. And yet, I kept binge eating. Why couldn't I stop? The coping question. When I concluded that making major life changes or finding personal fulfillment still wasn't the answer to curing my bulimia, I briefly considered going back to therapy. Maybe my therapist had been right all along, I thought. Maybe I really did need to get to the root of psychological causes of my eating disorder. Maybe some complex inner need was yet unfulfilled. After all, there were things about my life in Arizona that left me wanting more. I missed my family and friends, and although I talked to my mom on the phone every day and talked to my dad and sister at least once a week, I still wanted to see them. I didn't have much of a social network outside of work, and anxiety and depression hit me from time to time. So maybe I wasn't as content as I seemed on the surface. And maybe there were some hidden emotional issues causing me to binge? Although my intuition and my experience on Topamax suggested otherwise, I began to slip back into what I call the therapy mindset, the belief that I was diseased and somehow needed to binge eat to cope with life. Most of the time, it sure felt like I needed to binge eat. But no matter how right a binge felt in the moment or shortly afterward, before long, I felt that eating had done nothing to satisfy me, as if it were all some kind of dirty trick that I'd been dumb enough to fall for again. And I felt fat, disgusting, and shameful. Then, as always, I felt equally compelled to undo the damage, so I exercised frantically, which always helped a little. Exercise made me feel that I'd showed whoever or whatever pulled that dirty trick on me, that I wouldn't let myself become fat without a fight. However, I worried that eventually I wouldn't be able to do this anymore, that I would eventually start to binge without doing anything to compensate. After all, my body was getting tired, and the strenuous exercising was becoming more difficult for me over time. I intrinsically knew that binge eating really didn't help me cope with anything in my life. Instead, it only made my problems worse. I knew that whatever temporary benefits binge eating gave me, like tranquil sleep, pleasure, excitement, or numbness, weren't worth the cost. I knew that binge eating only made my relationship suffer and wasted valuable time, and I truly wanted to stop. But I couldn't. It only seemed logical then to conclude that I binged for very complex psychological reasons. Otherwise, I thought it would be easy to stop. So about 6 months after Greg and I moved into our new house, I began again to search for a complex answer to the question of why I binged. I asked myself, what is the deeper reason for all of this? What is binge eating helping me cope with? It wouldn't take me long to finally find the true answers to those questions, the answers that would propel me quickly into lasting recovery. Nevertheless, the answers were very surprising to me because they weren't complex at all. The answers were very simple, and they solved the mystery of my bulimia once and for all. Chapter 9. A New Book and New Hope. It was a warm day in May 2005, the beginning of an extremely hot summer in Arizona. I had binged horribly the night before and was driving to the gym, planning to do 6 hours of cardio and some weights. I was exhausted and I felt sick at the thought of working out. So instead of going directly to the gym, I stopped to procrastinate at a bookstore. I made my way to the psychology self-help section, a section I'd visited many times before, looking for a solution to my eating problems. Over the course of my bulimia, I'd read about 20 books that I thought might offer help or a cure. I'd read self-help books on eating disorders, books about finding happiness, developing self-esteem, relieving stress, finding spirituality, and overcoming depression. Although some of them helped me with other problems, none of the books stopped my binge eating. This particular day, I also wandered into the addiction recovery section, thinking that I might find something more useful there. I felt as though my behavior was indeed an addiction, not so unlike alcoholism or drug addiction. I looked over the titles and came across Rational Recovery, The New Cure for Substance Addiction by Jack Trimpe, which claimed to be an alternative to Alcoholics Anonymous. I picked it up out of curiosity because I had experienced Overeaters Anonymous, OA, a spin-off of Alcoholics Anonymous, AA, about 6 months before. I'd attended a few OA meetings and read some of the OA literature, but OA hadn't felt right to me, mainly because the group advocated a very strict diet that excluded all white flour and sugar. I knew that restricting food groups like fats and sweets had helped develop my problem in the first place, so more restriction wasn't the answer for me. Certainly I wanted to stop binging on sugar, white flour, and many other things, but I didn't want to stop eating them altogether. OA, as I understood it, asserted that eliminating those food groups was necessary because overeating was a disease that caused one to lose control when eating white flour and sugar. OA's position seemed to be that the disease could never be fully cured, only managed by eliminating the problem foods. I already disliked being on a meal plan, which I thought was necessary for my recovery, and I especially didn't like the idea of a meal plan that excluded foods I really liked. I found the OA members to be very nice, but the meetings were discouraging to me. No one in the group, except the moderator, seemed to have much success with remaining abstinent from problem foods or giving up overeating. OA was also unappealing to me because of what I thought was a religious overtone. OA does not claim to be religious, but I interpreted the higher power to mean God, the Judeo-Christian God that I learned about as a child. I had turned to God for help with my bulimia in my freshman year of college, but it didn't help. I had naively expected God to take away my desire to binge, but eventually, I came to believe that God does not do favors. And although people can derive strength from spirituality and prayer, we ultimately have to help ourselves. By the time college ended, I struggled to have any belief at all and saw religion as primarily an academic pursuit. OA, then, seemed like the wrong fit for me. Because of my lack of interest in OA, I was very interested when I found Rational Recovery, RR. Since the book claimed to be an alternative to AA, maybe it could be an alternative to OA as well, I thought. One sentence on the back cover caught my attention. It explained that RR disagreed with the idea of alcoholism as a disease and could give hope to those whom traditional treatment fails. This simple synopsis was enough to make me want to buy the book. Even if it turned out to be useless, at least it would distract me during the many hours on the treadmill, stair climber, and stationary bike. I purchased the book and drove to the gym. RR did much more than distract me from my workout. In fact, it did more to help me than anything else I'd tried before over the years. RR finally made me take full responsibility for my binge eating, then taught me how to do something about it. Something specific and targeted to my real problem. I didn't know it at the time, but the ideas in that book would lead me to complete recovery from bulimia. Chapter 10. My Two Brains. Within 5 minutes of starting my workout, Rational Recovery in hand, I learned the book's central tenet. Anyone can recover from alcoholism or another addiction whenever they want without treatment. The author, clinical social worker Jack Trimpe, believes that AA does a disservice to alcoholics by promoting the disease concept. The idea that drinking is not under an alcoholic's control, but a chronic disease. The author points out that society at large also embraces this disease concept of addiction, which only encourages and excuses addiction by failing to foster individual responsibility. Trimpe explains how he once shared AA's and society's view of alcoholism, and how this only served to help him avoid responsibility for stopping his destructive behavior. I believe that my desire to drink was irresistible, and that my own moment-by-moment drinking behavior was a symptom of something unknown and beyond my control. I sincerely believed it would take something besides my own critical judgment and self-control to take care of the problem. I surrendered to a highly gratifying belief that I drank for hidden causes and would need outside help of some kind to stop. When I read this, I immediately recognized that Trimpe's former beliefs about his alcoholism were quite similar to my beliefs about my bulimia. Like him, I believed that my binge eating had hidden causes and was a symptom of deeper problems. I decided to read Trimpe's words again, using a technique I learned from my brief experience in OA. I replaced the word drink in the text with the word eat. OA members perform this word substitution when they read material originally meant for alcoholics, like the 12 Steps and the Big Book. Read that way, It was as if the passage came straight from my own experience in therapy. An eating disorder is different from alcohol or drug addiction, but the similarities are plentiful. Whether someone is addicted to binge eating, drugs, alcohol, or any other vice, that person wants to quit but continues to drink, use, binge, despite efforts to stop. Furthermore, the act of binge eating, the feeling of pleasure, the relief from desire, and the numbing effect of large amounts of sugar and fat can certainly be as reinforcing as the effects of alcohol. I decided to read the rest of the book using the word substitution. However, I decided that for me, it was more useful to substitute the words binge eat for drink and bulimic for alcoholic. OA members traditionally replace alcoholic with compulsive overeater. I will use this word substitution throughout this chapter and any other time I refer to RR, even though I realize that substituting binge eating bulimic for drinking alcoholic does not create a perfect analogy. As I read further, I began to think about my own treatment and how I'd come to believe that I was flawed, defective, and not in control of my own binge eating. I thought about how I believed I ate because of my depression, anxiety, and low self-esteem. I thought back to my first experience in therapy when I was 16, when I'd first encountered the disease concept of an eating disorder. I remember the therapist telling me that my dieting and eating behaviors were merely symptoms of more difficult problems and part of an illness called anorexia. I'd been so put off by this concept of my eating disorder that I made a vow never to go back to therapy. Yet, when I'd returned to therapy in college, I'd come to accept the idea that I had some sort of illness and ate to cope with more difficult life issues. Even though my experience on Topamax had made me rethink what I learned in therapy, I still clung to the disease concept in many ways. Not only does the disease concept foster addiction, says Trimpe, but the treatments that stem from the disease concept are not effective. This is because treatment for bulimics assumes binge eating is the result of hidden causes. Therefore, therapy attempts to treat those causes instead of the bulimia itself and does not offer a direct way to stop binge eating. The treatments assume if you correct the hidden cause, the bulimic behaviors will unexplainably disappear. This was, in fact, what I had been trying to do in therapy for many years, without good results. Trimpe says that therapists convince bulimics that binge eating is a symptom of another problem. Therapists say that you cannot be free of bulimia until you reach other important goals. So instead of working directly on your addiction, you work on reaching other goals in hopes that your binge eating will go away. But the binge eating does not go away, Trimpe says. Even if you solve such problems as self-worth, self-awareness, relationships, and childhood conflicts, deprivations, and traumas, you are still left with your original desire to binge eat. Therapy's ideas may have been harmful. I was overwhelmed by what I was finding in RR, because this was the first time I'd read something that contradicted what I'd learned in my own treatment. For so many years, I searched for a hidden cause of my binge eating and tried to solve every problem I could think of. Yet all my self-improvement work had done a little to reduce my desire to binge eat. This was the first time I'd read something that suggested I could stop my destructive behavior without therapy or a long journey of self-discovery. It was the first time I'd read something that said recovery was not a difficult and life-consuming process. In fact, Trimpe says that trying to solve personal problems before recovery only wastes time and resources. Part of me agreed with every word I was reading because it explained why therapy had not worked for me. But another part of me resisted the information in RR. Maybe alcoholics could just quit, I thought. But eating disorders were more complicated. Wasn't it nearly impossible to self-recover from them? That warm spring day at the gym, I realized that the answers weren't clear and had never truly been clear. I had sensed something was wrong with eating disorder treatment when I was 16, even after I'd accepted the idea that binge eating was a coping mechanism that fulfilled inner emotional needs. A small part of me had remained unsure. The doubtful part of me didn't know how to express the problem I sensed in therapy through the years. But RR finally made me understand why therapy had not been effective for me. Therapy was not solving the real problem. If it hadn't been for my experience on Topamax in the summer and fall of 2003, I probably would not have been as open to the ideas in RR as I was. I probably would have resisted the concept that I could stop binge eating without solving my personal problems and without therapy. However, when Topamax was working, it temporarily corrected something in my brain that was generating my urges to binge, even as my other problems remained. Although the medication's effects weren't lasting, the experience had caused me to leave therapy, even though I still held to many of therapy's ideas. Reading RR made me wonder if those ideas were actually hampering my recovery instead of helping it along. I began to wonder why therapy had led me around the problem instead of targeting it directly. Maybe I could get better, I thought. Only if I stopped believing that I needed to travel a long journey of self-improvement in order to stop binge eating. Maybe I could get better only if I stopped trying to cure myself in a roundabout way. Maybe I could get better only if I stopped believing that I was using food to deal with unsettling emotions. Maybe I could get better only if I stopped believing that I had an illness and that I needed to become whole or become happy before I could give up my bulimia. I realized that solving my other problems might take a lifetime, but I needed to solve my real problem quickly. Addiction in light of the brain. RR suggested that this could be done by first understanding my own brain. Trimpy says that addictive behavior is understandable when viewed in the light of this remarkable organ. He explains that addiction comes from a part of the brain that is older in terms of evolutionary history. This area, which Trimpy calls the animal brain or beast brain, is responsible for maintaining our basic biological functions and ensuring our survival. The animal brain slash beast brain is the primitive brain region that generates our survival drives for food, water, sex, oxygen, and other things that it senses are necessary for survival. The animal brain is automatic, unthinking, and irrational. It is buried in the central region of the brain and surrounded by the wrinkled outer layer, the cerebral cortex. The animal brain is often referred to as the subcortex because it lies below the cortex, but I will continue to call it the animal brain and later the lower brain. The animal brains of humans are nearly identical to the brains of animals, as well as to much older species. The animal brain's function in humans is indeed fundamental to our survival as individuals and as a species. But when it comes to addiction, the animal brain works against us. When someone is addicted, the animal brain falsely believes that the addictive substance is necessary for survival, and therefore drives the addicted person to the substance, as though it is just as vital as water or oxygen. In my case, the animal brain believed that binge eating was unnecessary, so that an appetite for binge eating got mixed in with all of my other valid survival appetites. The animal brain expresses itself through what Trimpy has termed the addictive voice, AV. The AV is any idea, feeling, or behavior that supports binge eating. He says that a bulimic must be able to recognize her AV and separate herself from it, because the addictive voice is not really her voice. It is merely the voice of the animal brain. My animal brain was in control, directing my life as if large amounts of food were oxygen. I blindly followed the messages urging me to binge eat, unaware of their origin. Trimpy encourages bulimics to observe their own thoughts and feelings using a thinking skill he calls AVRT, Addictive Voice Recognition Technique. The thoughts and feelings that encourage binge eating are the AV, and those that support quitting are the true self. When a bulimic recognizes and understands her AV, then completely separates herself from it, recovery becomes effortless. She must get apart from it, Trimpy says, realizing that it is merely an appetite that originates in the biological animal side of human nature. It is not really you. It is housed in the animal brain, but the real you is located in a different part of the brain. The real you, or the true self, resides in the newer and more sophisticated part of the brain, the human brain, which is the part of the brain that developed most recently in evolutionary history. The human brain makes you yourself because it gives rise to your consciousness, self-awareness, identity, reason, memory, and intelligence. The human brain also controls your voluntary behavior because it houses the voluntary motor center, which controls any body part you can move voluntarily, including arms, legs, hands, mouth, and swallowing muscles. To stop binge eating, Trimpy says, you must know that your animal brain cannot make you do anything because it doesn't have control over your voluntary muscles. Because the human brain houses your true self and your voluntary muscle movements, you, your true self, have ultimate control. In the case of bulimia, it cannot control whether or not the bulimic will open the refrigerator or drive to the nearest fast food restaurant to binge. The only thing the animal brain can do on its own is send messages urging the bulimic to eat. But ultimately, the true self, residing in the human brain, is in control of what that person does upon hearing the call of the animal brain. Trimpy says that given the right information, the human brain is able to suppress any appetite, able to defeat any addiction, anytime you choose. Trimpy says that once you decide to quit and fully commit to stopping your binge eating, all you have to do is recognize the AV, realize that it is not really you, but instead it, the voice of the animal brain, and simply stop listening to it and letting it direct your actions. Even though you can hear and feel the AV urging you to binge, you know the animal brain cannot act on its own, so you know you can always choose whether or not to binge. Attempting to argue or reason with the AV is futile, he writes, because the animal brain is not rational and doesn't listen to reason. You only need to recognize it, ignore it, and it will soon fall silent. Trimpy says that once you learn to separate yourself from the animal brain and realize you are in control, your urges to binge begin to taper off, and stopping your addiction for good becomes easy. Chapter 11. I had control all along. This theory of two brains, the human brain and the animal brain, that Trimpy presented seemed reasonable to me. It seemed to explain why I sensed my urges to binge were not really me, but instead an imposter taking control of my mind and body, until I gave in and binged. It seemed to explain why part of me wanted to binge more than anything, and part of me truly wanted to quit. There were two brains in conflict within me. The most important thing I learned while reading RR at the gym that day was that I had ultimate control over my actions. My human brain, the seat of my intelligence, reason, language, and voluntary movement, was the only part of me capable of the voluntary act of binge eating. This new and rather simple information gave me a feeling of power. It gave me new hope that I could overcome my urges to binge eat. It gave me reason to believe I had a choice when the urges arose. In a sense, the information in RR was something I already knew, but hadn't been able to express. I'd already known that I didn't have to act on my urges to binge, even before reading the book. But until that point, I'd felt powerless against them. In therapy, I learned that I needed to develop alternative coping skills or fulfill my emotional needs in other non-eating ways. Yet when the urge to binge arose, it always seemed that nothing else but food would do. My urges weren't really me. RR seemed to explain why my urges were so irresistible. Maybe it was because I thought those urges signaled a real need, whether that need was physical, emotional, or even illness-based. Maybe I believed the thoughts and followed the feelings that were urging me to binge because I thought that they were my thoughts and my feelings. It only made sense that I believed this because the urges certainly seemed to be coming from me. When I had the urge to binge, I heard enticing thoughts in my own voice saying things like, "It won't hurt to binge just one more time. You can work out tomorrow and then start over. You've had a hard day and need to relax. You've done so well for the past 3 days, so you deserve it." I heard myself giving all the reasons that it would be okay to binge just one more time, and sometimes they seemed like very logical reasons. As the urge grew stronger, my feelings of anxiety and cravings mounted, and I felt I truly needed to binge in order to feel normal again. My feelings felt like my own as well, and like my thoughts, they expressed what I sensed to be a true need. RR made me realize that perhaps the thoughts and feelings that encouraged binge eating didn't correspond to any of my needs, real or symbolic, and that maybe those thoughts and feelings didn't even come from me at all. Maybe they were an automatic and unthinking voice coming from the more animalistic part of my brain and didn't have any power over me or my actions. Maybe all I need to do was separate my true self from that lower part of my brain for the urges to go away on their own. As I continued exercising and reading RR, I came to a significant realization. All through the years of therapy, I'd been trying to make my urges go away or prevent them from ever arising. But what if that was the wrong approach? What if I didn't need to make them go away, but just needed to change how I reacted to them? What if I could separate myself from the urges and choose not to follow them anymore? Perhaps, I thought, in spite of even the most powerful urge, I could choose not to open the refrigerator, not to drive to the convenience store, and maybe if I did that over and over, the urges would simply go away on their own. I decided to try what I learned from RR and my own insights that day. After all, what could it hurt? I wasn't having much success resisting my urges any other way. I decided to view any thought or feeling encouraging binge eating as an automatic function of my animal brain, believing that it had no power to affect my actions. I decided I would separate myself from my urges to binge and use the power of my human brain to choose not to follow them. It was about the food. When my day of working out was complete, and I had